Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, March 2nd, we discussed the Supreme Court's oral argument in Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee. My name is Evelyn Hildebrands, and I am Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Derek Muller. Professor Muller is a professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law, where his research and writing focuses on election law, particularly federalism and the role of states in the administration of elections. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. So be thinking of those as we go along and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. With that, thank you for being with us today. And Professor Muller, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. The Supreme Court heard its argument in Brnovich versus DNC, and this is a case that's been bubbling up in the lower courts and, didn't really have an effect on this presidential election, but understandably, all election laws have been drawing significant renewed attention, and every 4 years, it seems like we see more and more litigation over them. So Arizona had a couple of statutes on its books that were challenged by the Democratic National Committee. One was a longstanding statute prohibiting out-of-precinct ballots from being counted. If you cast your ballot in the wrong precinct, they would allow you to cast a provisional ballot. They take a look at it and determine whether or not you were actually erroneously excluded from that precinct. But if you're in the wrong precinct, they don't count the ballot. And the DNC said, well, this is a this violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It disproportionately and adversely affects minority voters who are more likely to cast their ballots outside of the precinct. You should at the very least count, things like statewide offices on that ballot, even if they're in the wrong precinct, if they're otherwise eligible voters. Additionally, there was a new statute passed a few years ago in Arizona to ban ballot harvesting or third-party collection of ballots. That is the opportunity for other individuals apart from you or your immediate family, county workers or postal workers, from collecting your ballot. And, concerns about voter intimidation, ballot fraud, all those kinds of things. So this was enacted in Arizona, and there was a challenge to that statute too, saying, listen, we can identify some of the racially tinged statements of a member of the legislature. We have a video showing some racially tinged commentary about the defense of this ballot harvesting ban. Additionally, we know that Native Americans and Hispanic voters are more likely to rely on third parties to carry their ballots on their behalf. The mail is much more difficult to obtain in portions of tribal reservations in Arizona. So this also provides a discriminatory burden. And the state of Arizona was defending both of these statutes, and again, under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And, one of the great challenges over the last decade, I would say, is that the courts, the lower courts, have been struggling to think about how to apply this provision of the Voting Rights Act when it comes to vote denial claims. That is, for a long time, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, starting with amendments enacted in the 1980s, has been used principally as a basis to ensure that minority voters have the opportunity to elect the preferred candidate of their choice. What that usually translates into is, in redistricting, ensuring that there are districts in which there are a sufficient number of minority voters who are able to elect the candidate of their choice, invoke dilution claims, if you will. If there is a district with a couple of districts that have black voters spread out among them, where their preferences are overwhelmed by white voters' choices, oftentimes a court will look and determine whether or not to draw a district to provide those black voters with a district to elect the preferred candidate of their choice. But unfortunately, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is not the clearest in language. It provides that if under the totality of the circumstances, the political processes leading up to the election in the state are not equally open to the participation by members of a class of citizens protected by subsection A, that is about providing the right to vote regardless of race or color, and that its members have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process, and to elect the representatives of their choice. So Arizona's defense of these statutes is to say these are, if you will, equal opportunity statutes. They treat all voters the same. Everyone has the opportunity, and it's actually an error to look at each one of these provisions separately. You should be looking at the total suite of voting opportunities available to voters. You should be looking at the fact that it's not just whether or not you can have a third party collect your ballot or voting out of precincts. You should look at all of the many other voting opportunities, in-person voting, early voting, absentee voting, all the variety and suite of opportunities available to you. And because of that, these opportunities are available to everyone, and we shouldn't really focus on, you know, the fact that it might inconvenience some subgroup of voters, particularly given that, you know, when it comes to out-of-precinct voting, it was less than 1%, if not less than 1,500ths of a percent of voters who had difficulty with the out-of-precinct voting policy. So this, in contrast, the Democratic National Committee was focused principally looking at the results, and that is if you can show some statistical disparity between populations of voters, and we are unable to sort of come forward, and we can establish that those disparities exist and interact with some historic socioeconomic conditions, along with the history of perhaps racial discrimination in the state, among other factors, then we can sort of say that these kinds of procedures are improper. They result in certain protected classes of individuals from being able to equally participate in the political process. So, yeah, and I would say that as the argument went on today, you know, there was a lot of discussion about should the focus really be on the opportunity and what that means? Should the focus really be on the results and what that means, and how do we assess it? But at the district court level, the district court, after a 10-day trial, concluded that despite the fact that there were some of these instances of racial overtones from at least one legislator and perhaps elsewhere in the record, that there was no finding of intentional discrimination, and finding that neither of these policies violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. When it was appealed to the Eighth Circuit, and a panel of the Eighth Circuit agreed, but then it went before an en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit, which reversed and found intentional discrimination on the part of the Arizona legislature, in addition to finding that both of these policies improperly abridged the right of minority voters to participate in the political process. The opinion sort of sweeps back to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and traces forward for over 150 years of Arizonan history to explain why this policy was discriminatory and disproportionately affected minority voters. So before the Supreme Court, you know, there is a sense in which there's this this finding of intentional racial discrimination on the part of the Arizona legislature that got some attention from members of the court. And in particular, how are we supposed to assess, you know, if we have on the record one member of the legislature, how do we assess, you know, his statements? How do we attribute them to the remainder of the legislature? And Chief Justice Roberts in particular was concerned about this kind of assessment. The Ninth Circuit had something of, if you will, a cat's paw theory, where in the old story where the monkey instructs the cat to get the chestnuts out of the fire, and it's the cat that actually burns his hand, but the monkey is really the one responsible, right? The argument being, if there's one legislator that is essentially providing these racially tinged statements, those can be attributed to the entirety of the legislature. Chief Justice Roberts was pretty strongly inclined against that kind of imputation of intent to the entirety of the legislature. But there was a number of sort of back and forth among some of the justices about evaluating the Arlington Heights factors, about evaluating whether or not it's a factor and how significant it is among sort of the remainder of the decision-making process that occurred. So there was that intentional discrimination claim. But then, you know, again, the heart of the matter was really looking at sort of how to examine a Section 2 claim under the Voting Rights Act and how to make this assessment, given that the language is not the most clear. And I think it was Justice Kavanaugh who late in the argument sort of was really emphasizing that it didn't feel like the party, at least at argument, were really sticking to a pure equal opportunity side of things versus a pure results side of thing. There was some suggestion about some sort of intermediate position and figuring out what that looks like. That is, if you can show some sort of result of a substantial substantial or significant, and you know, adjectives and adverbs like this were thrown about at the argument today. Some sort of substantial discriminatory impact on racial minorities. And then the question is, what do you do with that? If it looks like that there's something in the effects and the outcome. The statute doesn't speak in terms of intent. It just talks about equal opportunity. Does the state need to come forward with some evidence then to explain why it has done so? And if so, what are some of those, again, in the words of the statute, the totality of the circumstances that would allow a state to sort of defend the practice or policy? Is it concerns about fraud? Is it just sound election administration? A couple of notions that Justice Kavanaugh gravitated toward were saying, you know, if this is sort of a policy recommended by a bipartisan commission, for instance, the Jimmy Carter and James Baker had a bipartisan commission 15 years ago advocating for ending ballot harvesting in the United States, allowing immediate family members and household members and postal workers to carry your ballot, but not allowing third parties who could otherwise intimidate you. So that, in his view, would be a good circumstance that would justify Arizona's policy. Or if there are commonplace practices in other states, like out-of-precinct voting prohibitions. The Democratic National Committee pushed back to say, look, in Arizona doesn't not every county uses a precinct-based system. Some have vote centers, and the Carter-Baker Commission was not something the Arizona legislature relied upon, so we shouldn't be using those kinds of factors. But I think there's no question that there were concerns among the justices as they were offering hypotheticals about how are we supposed to assess, say, a poll closing at 7 p.m. And the effect that it has on voters. Real worries about thinking about how some of these rules would essentially invite litigation almost anywhere in the country to the extent that they could be shown to have any kind of disparate impact on some set of voters. There were a number of hypotheticals that were raised at various points throughout the argument that I think really tested the parties in some respects. One is Justice Kagan offered some hypotheticals about suppose there's a country club puts all of its polling, or that all the polling places are put at country clubs in the state. And we know that black voters have to drive 10 times as far to places that are traditional to traditionally hostile toward black voters. For the Republican Party, there was a suggestion. Yeah, it was, in fact, that might actually be less of an opportunity, even though it's a facially neutral rule. And Justice Barrett later in the argument said, well, it seems like you're putting a lot of work on opportunity here then, right? Because it does seem like we're talking about outcomes in these cases, right? It seems like if you're saying that there's some notable difference and we're supposed to take demographic differences into account, it does seem like opportunity is doing a little bit more work here than you sort of let on by just saying there's some equality in treatment at the front end. On the other side, when challenging the Democratic position, Justice Alito offered some hypotheticals to try to figure out what this would look like applying it to some rules. When it came to something like, you know, suppose that there's a challenge to a voting policy where there's 2 weeks of early voting and someone wants it to become 60 days of early voting, and we have some evidence of disparate effect on minority voters, or about suppose ballots are supposed to be received within 3 days after the election, but someone is able to challenge to say they should really come in 1 week after the election. And the responses were again, not very persuasive in saying, well, I mean, statistical disparities alone are not enough. We have to look at socioeconomic factors. And again, I don't think that gave much comfort to Justice Alito. If that's what the evidence shows, then it would suggest that there's essentially plaintiffs would always be able to find a population that could be adversely affected by an existing law, and then bring in a challenge to potentially sweep in every kind of election law. So late in the argument, Justice Kagan suggested it was not clear how much daylight there was between the two parties, but undoubtedly there was some question about, first, you know, what is that sort of position in between equal opportunity at the front end, facially neutral laws that appear equally open to everyone, versus the back end of a pure results test. Any statute that has any disparate impact on some subpopulation on the basis of race or color. And given that, there was, I think, you know, some effort on the court to figure out what kind of evidence would the state have to put forward that would therefore justify its position, or how often should it have to be dragged into court to demonstrate that. A couple of last points, and then I look forward to your questions, because again, I think there was a lot of uncertainty going forward and a lot of freewheeling opportunity for the court to think about how these things work. One is, you know, Justice Barrett and others had mentioned about this concern thinking about what's an inconvenience in voting versus a burden in voting. And this came out also early in the argument from Michael Carvin and others to suggest that we need to think about the ordinary burdens of voting, as you might say, in a case like Crawford versus Marion County, the voter identification case, where that is, there are just the things you have to affirmatively do. You have to go register, or you have to go request a ballot, or you have to fill out the ballot, or you have to do things. And so there is a notion that there's some ordinariness to these election laws and figuring out where that sort of threshold, you know, resides. And I think it was Justice Breyer who laid in the argument sort of really emphasized that he was concerned about some kind of test where we're worried about sort of just chance disparities between racial populations. And so he really wanted to emphasize language like a significant difference in minority populations and their ability to participate in the political process. So I think, you know, overall, I think the parties were struggling figuring out how to identify the outer bounds of some of the arguments that the courts were raising. On the one hand, Democratic National Committee, as the respondents here, they didn't want to suggest that every election law was going to be subject to litigation and potentially ripe for review if you're able to demonstrate some socioeconomic disparities. At the same time, I'm not sure that they appeased the fears of many on the court about that finding. On the flip side, I think the petitioners and state of Arizona, you know, wanted to recognize that there are kinds of rules that can adversely and significantly adversely affect certain minority populations in voting without conceding that sort of everything should be called into question, and figuring out at what point have we said there's a lack of opportunity up at the outset. So I think this is the challenge, thinking about that sort of middle line and how to put a cognizable test from the Supreme Court to the lower courts that is going to be administrable, that's going to adhere even loosely to, the opportunity language within the Voting Rights Act, while at the same time not calling into question the vast majority of election laws in the United States, especially those, you know, like out of precinct policy in Arizona that have been around for quite some time. So that's Brnovich. I think it's anyone's guess about how the Supreme Court comes out here, but I sort of hold off to see, oral argument is one thing, and put pen to paper is another. But with that, I look forward to any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you so much. We'll now go to audience questions. And with that, we'll turn to our first caller in the queue.
Thank you. Sir, this is Dan Mornoff from the American Civil Rights Project. And I know that you mentioned that the court, I think you said specifically the chief, was very seemed concerned by the potential use of legislative history, and specifically these racial comments by a particular member, and imputing them to the rest of the membership of the legislature. I can't help noticing that a good deal of the party's arguments seem to have centered on the presence of socioeconomic disparities and history, none of which is actually in the Voting Rights Act, all of which comes from the Voting Rights Act's legislative history, and specifically from the committee report. And I guess I wonder, was there any skepticism expressed over reliance on that to distinguish what minority populations will be protected and what minority populations will not?
Great. There's a lot there. I think there's a couple components to think about. One is on the legislative intent side. So it's tricky because there's sort of legislative intent as a motivator for or an impetus for enacting legislation, and legislative intent, as a means of interpreting a statute. And so there's no question that these are both questions of legislative intent. But, you know, as the former, that was one of the things that really drove the Ninth Circuit's finding. And frankly, I'm not sure there's much appetite on the Supreme Court to say that Arizona was intentionally racially discriminatory in this decision. And again, I think it was Chief Justice Roberts who was very skeptical about imputing the actions of one legislator to the rest of the legislature. Justice Thomas was also concerned about this theory that the Ninth Circuit adopted. So that's on sort of one side. On the other side, as you point out, one of the famous things that has come out of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the interpretation of the Supreme Court in Thornburg versus Jingles, the case that essentially established some of the vote dilution tests for determining whether or not to draw a majority-minority district, is a series of factors that comes from a Senate report. Again, deep legislative intent here, that courts are supposed to consider to determine whether or not, the circumstances suggest that there's sort of racial polarization in the electorate, or how we go about assessing whether or not that a particular minority group has been burdened in terms of the opportunity to participate in the political process. And some of those factors were raised at argument today, including the fact that we're supposed to look at some of the statements of the legislature. But there wasn't a whole lot of pushback from the members of the court about this. I think part of it stems from the fact that you do have this language in the Voting Rights Act that talks about based on the totality of the circumstances. And given that the totality of the circumstances is just there as a number of circumstances, again, Justice Kavanaugh was suggesting a couple of circumstances that he thought in his view would be useful consideration. The fact that there are these Senate factors to consider, the including socioeconomic disparities, has not, I think, been overly controversial from courts. Just that if they're deciding to make up totality of the circumstances anyway, why not look at some of the things that the Senate might have done as much as anything a court might determine is a relevant circumstance. And I think occasionally you saw in the court today some pushback about how we're supposed to think about those circumstances. Again, I think Justice Kavanaugh was emphasizing more the concern about, what other states have done or whether or not there's some widespread practice or justification for it. On the flip side, Michael Carvin was pressing back on the use of socioeconomic status to suggest, I think there's a concern here that socioeconomic status becomes ubiquitous and it sort of binds all state decision making going forward, because socioeconomic status is always going to be something that states can look to identify racial disparities. So some members of the court, I think, had expressed some skepticism when the DNC had suggested use of socioeconomic status as this additional sort of factor beyond just disparity. But I think there's just a question about how much independent work socioeconomic status is doing. And so if there's not a whole lot of independent work it's doing, if it's largely overlapping with race, I think it's going to make some members of the court uncomfortable of using it. But that said, there wasn't significant interest from the court, I think, in revisiting some of these Senate factors, or there wasn't a whole lot of emphasis to discuss what socioeconomic status looked like, at least from the eyes of the justices.
Great. Thank you. And we'll now move to our next caller.
Thank you. So from the academic side, from Carlos from the University of Chicago, can you talk a little bit more about what was the court's perspective from kind of the statistical matters and the technical side of determining, I think what you refer to as kind of like a factual basis kind of the academic literature being what it is, did they give us some clear direction there on methods? Thank you.
Yeah, so they didn't offer a whole lot. I'll give you a couple of ways that the court thought about it. So one was, you know, Justice Thomas at one point in the argument pressed about the percentage of voters who were affected by the out-of-precinct policy, for instance. And the state sort of conceded, well, it's less than 1%, but, you know, just because it's a small number doesn't mean it's something that is somehow exempted from, protection. And Attorney General Brnovich mentioned, you know, I think that there were 4,000 ballots that were affected by the out-of-precinct policy in the last election, which when you consider the size of Arizona, you know, is a very small figure. And then, you know, at other points in time, there were suggestions that it was black voters or minority voters would be affected at a rate of 2 to 1 that were affected by the outside precinct policy. So at least you could say there's some disparity, but when it's, a few thousand, how are we supposed to assess that in the overall sort of scheme of things? Additionally, Justice Kagan pressed repeatedly on a series of arguments where she talked about black voters that would be affected at 10 times the rate of white voters, that it would disproportionately affect them at a 10x factor, essentially. And so, you know, the court had sort of moved around on some of these ideas about how, like, are we supposed to be looking for some sort of threshold? Like, what is the size? Is it sort of a raw numbers that we're concerned about, too? Again, Justice Thomas suggested that there might need to be some minimum threshold of a number of voters that would be adversely affected. Do we care about the quantity, the quantity, the difference between the two groups? And again, if the existing record is maybe 2 to 1 or other places in the record that didn't come out at oral argument, it might have been 4 to 1, but a very small, low overall percentages. Justice Kagan was looking at, again, 10 times factors. And Justice Breyer was using words like significant to try to figure out if there's some sort of standard that moves beyond. But there wasn't a whole lot of discussion. I mean, there were no regression analyses coming from the Supreme Court at oral argument. There were no, I think the language out of the court's partisan gerrymandering cases has made it clear that, you know, they're much less interested in providing that kind of guidance to the courts below. So there wasn't a whole lot except some of those things that I've mentioned.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And while we're waiting for additional questions, I'd like to ask, do you, Professor Miller, know of cases that are in the wings that may be affected one way or the other by the Supreme Court's decision when it comes down?
So I have to kind of go back and figure out where some of these things are. I think there's no question that some of the voter identification cases, I'm trying to figure out which ones are in preliminary injunction mode or which ones are at the en banc mode, are some of the ones that I would be thinking about. But this is sort of the principal Section 2 case, at least, that's come up in recent years. There's some of the older ones like Texas's voter identification law and VC and Lee, the Fourth Circuit case involving a voter identification case. There are some of these that have happened in the past, and I'm just trying to think offhand about which one of those are sort of still in the queue. The 2020 election yielded far more questions about what we might describe as sort of some of the non-racial concerns about voting practices, particularly in light of COVID. And lower courts were very inclined to use, you know, what we refer to as the Anderson balancing test from a line of cases preceding, but also after a Supreme Court's decision in 1983, where it sort of examines the character and magnitude of the burden on the right to vote with the state's justification. So there have been a lot of cases that have come out of the lower courts in the last year dealing with these questions, and many of them on a preliminary basis. But the Section 2 cases have not attracted nearly as much attention, at least that from my recollection in the last year. And so we're sort of waiting, I think, to see how this case comes out for the decision about how plaintiffs are going to proceed in future cases. And again, maybe some of those other ones, voter ID cases, are sort of churning around in the lower courts, and we'll see how they'll come out.
Great. Were there any surprises that you can think of that you expected the justices to focus on and then they didn't, or the other way around in oral argument today?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little surprised there wasn't more attention paid to the intentional discrimination finding, which I thought might have been a clean opportunity for the court to send this back. But instead, I think this really is the court really grappling with how to provide some guidance to lower courts on a Section 2 claim in general when it comes to vote denial questions. Someone who claims that they are unable to vote because of a voting regulation, and how we think about that when it comes to race. So it's undoubtedly a significant case. It's going to be as significant, I think, as Thornburg versus Jingles was in 1986, when it established the test for how to do vote dilution claims under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion about the sort of constitutionality or authority of Congress to enact this provision. Instead, it seemed much more like the justices were trying to grope around to find the appropriate kind of test that could be administered. So I do think we're going to see, but before argument, I wasn't necessarily sure, how the court was going to go, if it was going to find a way to punt this case. But I'm increasingly convinced that I think the court is going to try to come up with some kind of standard that it believes will be administrable for lower courts that will not call into question every kind of election rule and figuring out how to write that and provide guidance going forward.
And then this is not to exactly put you on the spot, but if you had to gaze into a crystal ball... What would your speculation be?
Well, that's a foolish effort now. There's no question. I do think the court is not going to stick with solely some sort of equal opportunity, if you will, right? I think they're willing to look at disparate impact, disparate effect in some respect. But I don't think it's going to be, some kind of test that Justice Breyer in particular was suggesting maybe we can graft on a civil rights kind of, framework onto what the courts are doing here. And so I think it's trying to figure out what quantum of discriminatory impact is going to be sufficient to give rise to a claim here. And then, saying, well, what's the state's justification? And I think probably providing a relatively low barrier, at least to this, to the extent that it's a practice that's long been on the books or widely adopted by other states or recognized as acceptable, right? My sense is the court is not going to compel the state to make a state-specific justification. It will be able to draw upon more generic evidence, which is consistent with how the court did the voter ID case in Crawford versus Marion County and other kinds of election cases to speak of its more general justification. So that would be my rough guess about how it comes out. And I think that means Arizona doesn't get everything it wants, but it's going to probably put Arizona in a much better position when the case is sent back to the Ninth Circuit in a way that it would likely win, would be my guess.
That's a good guess. All right, we'll move to our next caller.
Thank you very much again for your insights. I have a quick follow-up since... So here's a question. Anything on cost-benefit analysis, causality, data-driven policymaking, any kind of quantitative type approaches, broadly speaking, were mentioned? You mentioned significance, so is it fair to imply statistical significance? I at this point may be reading tea leaves because maybe that's all they said, but did you see any overall trend on concrete mentions of methodology, or they were a lot more worried about these gross quantitative measures? Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think they definitely did not talk about sort of any of the data-driven kinds of questions that you've alluded to. I think, some of the questions talked about or conceded statistical disparity or talked about how do we handle statistical disparity. And I think, Justice Alito was pushing to say, let's assume we can find statistical disparity, right? He would suggest things like that. And again, I think... the respondents emphasize, statistical disparity is not enough. We're also looking at some of the past reality and how it interacts with the socioeconomic status of others. Again, I think, the petitioners would push back to say, well, there's always going to be that socioeconomics, evidence that you can put forward. Therefore, any statistical disparity is always going to be enough to win on this claim. But speaking, generally, they sort of spoke... at a level to sort of concede that there were going to be statistical differences. And again, I think you're right to say when Justice Breyer emphasizes he wants to find some quantum that gets beyond de minimis, was another word used at times, to suggest that, you know, there are these things that might be random or attributable to chance, find something that's a little bit farther. So there is some suggestion, you know, but again, I think the court is very reluctant to sort of put some kind of, you know, standard deviation model into thinking about how we're supposed to think about disparities here, right? I think the court doesn't want to sort of read into the statute these kinds of strict rules that might not otherwise exist. And so it did tend to speak more generally in terms of statistical differences rather than sort of any particular measure.
So fair to say quantification is useful, but not determinant.
Yes, I would say that's fair.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And at this point, I would just hand the floor back over to you to make any closing remarks that you would like to make.
Well, thank you. Well, like I said, I think my assumption is Arizona wins and it'll be sent back with a win. And I think the question is more about how it's going to look. And I think the court is genuinely trying to figure out how to flesh out what is, ambiguous language at best from the Voting Rights Act and figuring out how to provide some sort of application to lower courts moving forward. So it's going to be a wait and see. You know, I would not expect this one until late June. We shall see what the court does with this case.
Wonderful. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for calling in and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming Teleform calls and virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.